The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets are back in sell mode. Trade tariffs spark concerns. The dollar hits resistance and then falls. And our guest today, Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 550 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to March. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And yeah, it's March 2018, and the volatility that we thought maybe had subsided a little bit from what we saw in February seems to have come back with a vengeance. Markets have been moving around pretty wildly again, 500, 600 points in the Dow on a daily basis, 1% to 2% swings on a daily basis. And a lot of that is due to the concern that, well, maybe valuations got ahead of itself. Fine. Okay. Some technical levels. Yes. We'll talk about that in a second. And of course, some of the policy decisions that are coming out of Washington. The biggest issue that really started to get people worried last week was the idea that, wait a minute, we're listening to the new Fed chief, the chair, speak in front of Congress, and he's sounding a little bit hawkish. Wait, that can't be. Wait a second here. Hold on. The Fed is supposed to be always supportive of markets, right? The Fed is always supposed to be kind of dovish, right? All of a sudden, we're seeing that Jay Powell is now talking about a really robust economy, a great situation when it comes to the labor markets, looking at the outlook very in a positive manner. And I thought, wait a minute, that's all good news, right? The problem is he also didn't put aside some of the concerns and really put them to rest about, well, how many rate hikes are we going to see this year? Is it only going to be three? Maybe. Oh, hopefully less. Is it going to be four? Oh, man, that would be a problem. But he made a few statements that were very much disconcerting to those market participants who really want rates to stay low for a much longer period of time. He talked about the fact that some of these low inflation numbers that we're seeing are transitory. Well, that's not really beneficial for those that are really thinking that there is going to be no inflation in the future. It's staying calm. The Fed chair, the organization that has been talking down the effects of inflation for years and talking about how they want to reach their level, and they don't see it getting there for some time, and therefore we'll have to have a lot of stimulus in place forever. Now all of a sudden talking a different story. So we see that the dollar started moving up and breached an important resistance level midweek after Powell talked. We saw the bond started to sell off again, and that got markets pretty nervous. And then there was a follow-up. A couple days later, he was speaking again, and as it was expected, kind of walked back some of the harshness of his tone in terms of his excitement over the economy and the fact that there may be a continuation of rate hikes until this inflation thing, which isn't there yet, is, you know, put under control. However, on the heels of that, we started to hear more about trade tariffs. President Trump started talking about, well, we may not be announcing it today as expected. That was on Thursday. There was an expectation about 10 o'clock in the morning or so that trade tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum were going to be put out there. Trade tariffs on steel. I mean, it's an important industry, no question about that. It hits a lot of areas. I mean, automobiles, cars, aluminum, you know, Coca-Cola. I mean, it kind of could go through the entire gambit of areas that this industry touches. It's a lot. I mean, building, construction, it's a lot. And we're thinking about a 25% tariff on steel. Oh, man. Countries around the world were pissed. And it didn't seem like we got any really good data, research, or backup on why this tariff was going to be put in place. And the impact on markets was pretty severe. You wouldn't think so initially. Why would that really be very impactful? Because it did help the steel companies in the U.S. It hurt a lot of companies outside the U.S. that are involved in iron ore and steel and aluminum. But the problem is the concern that markets have over the potential for a trade war. And that wasn't helped at all. Early Friday morning at about 6:10 a.m. when President Trump tweeted that, yeah, well, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, maybe a trade war is good. He used the word trade war and we'll win. You know, trade war and we'll win. But he used the word trade war. Now, again, there's certain things you got to tread a little bit lightly on because sometimes, you know, holding a big stick but walking gently and softly with it is all you need as opposed to whacking everything with the stick. There's no reason to waken, you know, a sleeping bear. You want to nudge him? Fine. Don't poke him. And when it comes to trade, it's a global situation now. We have more of a global economy today and a globalized overall program of trade than ever before. It's all interconnected. You start putting tariffs on them. They start thinking about, let's see what we're going to do here. Now, you would think that with all that we just said with regard to the Fed's discussion and inflation, that bonds would continue to sell off. And they did. With the tariff situation here, the problem you may have is that may reignite the sell-off. Now, a day after Powell spoke, again, he walked some of it back, so the bonds relaxed a little bit. People were buying them, especially as the markets were coming down. They're like, all right, you know what? Maybe we need to buy some bonds here. Get out of stocks. But the problem is that you start poking the bear and disrupting the global economy, other things could happen. For example, what if China and Japan decide not to play? What if they decide, you know what? You're going to put tariffs on? Yeah, maybe we'll come in a little bit lighter at the next Treasury auction. Very possible. And especially because we have a huge fiscal deficit to fund, we need them buying our bonds. So this is not, I just got to tell you, I don't think this is the smartest economic move I've ever seen. We did see steel companies move up very nicely on this. I would say that the right thing to do is probably fade some of these because I just can't imagine going into this with, and also the WTO and may find this illegal like they did years back with the Bush tariffs on steel. So one quick thing before we get to our guest more, of course, if you want to argue that with me or contact me, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew section, and just submit your question, comment, or, you know, ridicule, whatever you want on that. Just to mention something, the S&P 500 tried to stay over its 50-day moving average. The reason I'm bringing up technicals a lot lately is in a volatile market that is news-driven, headline-driven, and emotionally driven, it's very difficult to utilize fundamentals for price targeting. What you need to do sometimes is look at some of the technicals to keep your mind straight and from maybe making the wrong decision. And one of the things that we noticed and I've been talking about and I've been tweeting about and I've been putting up charts and talking about this is, for example, the 50-day moving average that was, you know, it's been acting as support and resistance depending on which side we're on here. The S&P 500 attempted to stay above the 50-day moving average, which was a key level, very key level, because it is. We've talked about this before. It's a key level because institutions say it's a key level. Once the price dropped below support, it dropped pretty hard. And then all of a sudden, the 100-day moving average came in as the next level of support. And now we have the 200-day moving average that is the flush low from February 9th that is also an important level. So remember something. There's a lot of things you can look at, like Fibonacci's, maybe some moving averages clearly. I have some things that we've developed over the years called volume at time, or market profile is a better way to really consolidate that. Where we look at, you know, where's the volume coming in? Where are the holes where there's been no volume? Where's the flush levels? I can see that very clearly on a chart from levels that we have drawn on there. And we do that with TradeStation. I think I've told you that before. And those are all available through trigger charts on the TradeStation trading app store. But commercial aside there, the fact is that you need technicals in a volatile market because there really is nothing else to hold on to. You got to grab what you can. Because if fundamentals aren't telling the story of what's going on, okay, well, let's kind of see where the levels are and where to possibly have an entry or an exit from a stock until things change. So consider brushing up on your technical analysis, your education on that, and there's plenty of ways to do that. So I just think that's something to take a look at. But anyway, let's get right down to our discussion with our guest of the week. And our guest today is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research, CurzioResearch.com. He's been on the show many times because he's one of the favorite guests on the Disciplined Investor podcast. And this for good reason, because he's always bringing some really nice ideas, some information that is really usable. So that's what's good. Plus, he has this really great, weird New York accent that just won't quit. So Frank Curzio is on the show. Right, Frank?
That's it. I'm going to just talk the whole entire time so people can make fun of my accent.
Yeah, I like it.
I realized a long time ago I'm never going to change it. I always wanted to change it, and I said, you know what? This is me. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. So, but what are you going to do?
You know, it's funny because I look at – I'm from New York originally as well, out on Long Island, and I saw some video when I was a kid. And we were playing the video, you know, the VHS and all that. And somebody said, who's talking right there? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. Honestly, I had no idea who was talking. I said, my gosh, he's got this crazy, weird, hardcore Long Island, New York accent. And I'm like, I don't know. And then all of a sudden the camera pans on me when I was, you know, like maybe 15 years old. And I'm talking, I'm like, oh my God. I was like, I sounded like that? Like crazy.
I know, it's cool.
But let's talk about the market, because a lot to talk about in terms of what's been going on. I've been kind of going through a lot of different things with my listeners about the issue with the U.S. dollar and bond rates and some of the hawkishness that's going on with the Fed and some of the discussion of economics looking really good, but very inflationary. So I want to kind of talk about that. I also want to talk about some of your recent stock picks. You were on last, I think it was December 3rd of 2017. You made some very interesting calls that were very against the mainstream of what people were thinking. And I want to talk about, because I track all this, I want to talk about how that actually turned out. But let's talk about the markets. So we've seen a lot of volatility that's hit in recently. Big change from what we saw just, let's say, the last, I don't know, 24 months, where there was no volatility. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is, with the volatility now, is that back to the normal levels of volatility, or was the last, let's say, 18 months or so an aberration, or is this the problem time that's kind of against the grain?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the last 18 months, if even go back further, right, Andrew, if we look at since 1980, we've had a correction in the markets every single year until 2016, right? So we're looking, whatever that is, do the math, 35, 37 years, whatever that is. What does that mean? A correction is defined as a 10% pullback from its highs. So if you look at that and say the market pullback every single year, and that happened every single year until 2017. And not only did that happen, 70% of those times, of those years, the market finished a year higher. Now, that what does that tell you? It tells you that pullbacks are normal, right? They're normal occurrences. Mm-hmm. They happen all the time. Yet, what did we see in 2017? We saw the stock market go up every single month. The last time that happened, never in the history of the markets. It went up every single month. It finished the year, it finished every month higher than when it started. And that was just in 2017, where January we did the same thing. And then also the last correction before that was 6 months prior. It was like July 2016. So we look at a market that's going up so much, people get conditioned to the point where, wow, it's going up, it's high, it's great. And when we see a pullback of this magnitude, and we, especially over the past few years, whenever we've seen a pullback, it happens right away. And now the social media presence and how we know it, everything the second it happens, I mean, people just, what do people have fresh in their heads? Well, the last time we really saw a market like this and really come down was the credit crisis. So everybody's like, oh, there's a credit crisis all over. And you get all these perma bears going crazy, posting all this crazy stuff when this is a normal reaction. This is normal. We got well ahead of ourselves. We needed to pull back. It's a healthy market. Not every single stock should be going up. They, you know, they were all going up in tandem, basically. And it was a normal reaction. So with me, I was telling I've never seen so many nervous people. I've been doing this for over 20 years. And when my subscribers and everybody emailing me, which is fine, I get it, I understand. So it was my job, like everything's good. The underlying economy is fine. Banks are fine. It's not the credit crisis. This is normal. Just, you know, hey, be smart. You should have been taking profits a little bit because you're up so much. And look for those names you want to buy 15, 20% lower. And you're probably glad you did that because the market really rebounded nicely over the past couple of weeks.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a variety of groups of people. So you have those that are like, okay, market's too high. I'm not buying, right? Those same people are, oh my gosh, the market's selling off. I'm not buying, right? You know, I don't want to buy. I'm waiting for lower prices. But when the prices get low and they start moving lower in a quick fashion, which just everybody to know something, that if you look historically, and right to what Frank was saying here, if you look historically, the up moves generally happen over time slowly. And when you look at a bull market, it takes a long time. You know, you see this nice movement up and corrections happen very quickly, as he mentioned. So what I'm saying is that when you look over time and through time, it's usually unless you have some really bad stuff going on for a very long time, like you may have a credit crisis, for example. But still, that top to bottom of, let's say, a 40-something percent correction happened in about a year and a half, right? And a lot of it really only happened in a few months. Whereas the rebound on the upside took years in the making. So corrections happen very quickly because people are very afraid. They're very concerned. They're very scared. And what do? They push the sell button. And when you push the sell button, well, obviously everybody starts to, you know, pile onto that and it becomes a very fearful situation and things get out of hand. Whereas buying takes a much longer time to kind of make its way through markets. So I agree with you that corrections are very normal, or downstrokes are normal. It was very abnormal last year to see the markets just go up no matter what. Even when they were down, they seemed to be up in 2017. And then we had, if you really kind of want to look at this and dissect this, I think you'd probably agree with this. We had a blow off top in January where everybody was just so thinking, hey, you know what? Last year, maybe I didn't get in. I'm finally going to get in here. Everybody pushed their money in. As money went in, everybody's like, oh, look, it's going up. I don't want to miss out on this. So kind of January was that point of, hey, wait a minute, maybe things are a little bit too hot. But now we have an economy that is doing really well. The global economy, generally speaking, there's a couple of places that aren't doing as well. But the U.S. economy, you know, you look at the ISM that came out this week, it was looking good. New home sales are starting to sag a little bit. Consumer confidence has, really high numbers. We're seeing that the jobs numbers are coming in very good. You know, all across the economic spectrum for the United States, things are looking pretty good. The question is, are we possibly entering into a time where, you know, news is too good, where it may actually be perceived as bad news that the Fed may raise rates or the dollar may move up higher? I mean, is this a kind of a situation we may be entering into?
I think those are short-term trends, Andrew. Like, I think that's more like trading when you're looking at that. When you see, okay, well, is this good news or bad news? And everyone says, well, the Goldilocks scenario is perfect, right? Where we're not growing too fast, right? So if we're not growing too fast, that's okay. We're not seeing inflation go up high. That's why we don't raise rates. But we're not growing too slow. It's deflationary trends. So when you have that middle, it seems, you know, that's when the market really outperforms. But, you know, we had the Fed chair a couple of days ago say that, hey, you know what, we're going to, I don't see anything wrong with this economy right now. We're going to continue to raise rates, and the market sold off. I think that's a buying opportunity. You have to realize that we had stimulus in this market for way too long. And it's almost like you're riding a bike and you have training wheels. And training wheels are cool because you're never going to fall. You're okay, but you can't go far. You can't ride fast or do anything. Now we're starting to take those training wheels off. What does that mean? It means that maybe the banks don't need to keep enough capital on their balance sheets to withstand a 30% market correction, a 10% unemployment rate, and a 35% drop in housing prices, which, by the way, hasn't happened, not even the last credit crisis. It happened back in the Great Depression. That's how much capital they're forced to keep on their banks. Now, I'm not saying that, okay, let these guys go wild, and, you know, I agree with you, you know, the stuff they got away with during the credit crisis, the greed and stuff. Forget about that and forget about your emotions, because this is about the stock market and you want to make money. When you look at that, where I can see deregulation coming down the line, yes, interest rates are going to go high. If you look at good gauges, if you look at GDP, right, the nominal rate is close to 5%. Nominal rate is just GDP plus inflation. When you have that rate, it usually should be around 2% within that range where you're looking at you know, interest rate. I mean, we should be around 3%, right? We should be around 3%, and we're not close to that. It doesn't mean they're going to go up to 3%, but what it tells you is we're going to see more rate hikes. And what the Fed is saying is that, hey, the underlying economy is good. We're fine. We could take it. And that's actually a positive, because you're going to see not every stock do well. You're going to see companies that use a lot of leverage and higher debt. I get the higher interest rates. Maybe the housing market comes down a little bit. But historically, when we see a Fed that raises rates, as they're raising rates, stocks usually do good during that tightening cycle. It's when they end that tightening cycle, that's usually when they come off. And we're not close to ending that for at least another 12 to 18 months.
12 to 18 years, the way the Fed, this Fed is.
Well, you know what's good too also? Say if we do run into another crisis, well, we're at zero interest rates. It's pretty scary. Yeah, we could backstop the whole entire world like we did, you know, during the credit crisis. But when we have higher interest rates and say, you know, that gives us a chance to really stimulate the economy if we need to, right? So we could actually lower rates in the future. So we should be trading above 2%, maybe 2.25% around there. We're going to get there eventually, but you know, higher interest rates, I think, is just programmed in everyone's head that automatically you're going to sell stocks. It's going to be terrible. It's horrible. But the Fed is saying that, you know, finally our economy is really doing great on its own. Things are great. And you can't discount tax reforms. I mean, that's a massive, massive game changer. Mm-hmm. I don't care what kind of what side you're on, Democrat, Republican, whatever. The earnings right now, Andrew, are incredible. And this isn't a one-time thing. I mean, this is something that's going to – I mean, look at the amount of businesses that paid out money to pay out bonuses. You're looking at buybacks. Buybacks are – I think it was the ninth highest last quarter than ever.
Yeah, February was an astounding number.
February last month.
Astounding.
Yeah, so it was in the top 10 ever in buybacks, most buybacks ever. You're looking at these companies, you know, paying their employees, they pay their employees, are going to spend more money to the economy. You're looking at an earnings number that's up to $155. That's the expectations. If you look at that number, again, this isn't like a Bush tax cut. Here's a couple thousand dollars for you. This is, I mean, the amount of money businesses are going to make and what they're going to do with this is incredible. And when you look at that number, you look at the S&P 500, we're really trading around 16, 17 times forward earnings. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's the same multiple we traded on average for the past 5 years. So if you think the market is expensive now, it means you thought the market was expensive for the last 5 years, and look what happened. Now, one last thing here, and I want people to realize, it doesn't mean the market can't come down. It doesn't mean we can't have risks. What I'm saying is what, just because the stock market goes higher, it doesn't mean it's expensive, as long as earnings are growing. So if earnings are growing faster than the market, the stock market can go at 50%. If earnings are growing 100%, the market's cheaper now, even though it went up 50%. And I think people are programmed where, wow, the S&P 500 keeps going higher and higher. But we're seeing that earnings growth, double-digit earnings growth, some of the fastest earnings growth we've seen in the past 10 years. It's supporting this. I'm not saying to go all in and it's great, but you could find a lot of really good ideas. And we're not as expensive as the entire world is saying, and you got to worry and stuff like that. There's a lot of positives in this market right now.
Let me just play devil's advocate for just 1 second on a couple of things here and get your opinion on this. Because, you know, for years, everybody's been hearing, hey, don't fight the Fed, which, by the way, is very good advice, right? Don't fight the Fed. If Fed is going into a standpoint where they're going to, you know, give stimulus and they're going to reduce rates, don't fight the Fed. Because the problem is the more you have in terms of stimulus and the lower the rates are, well, it makes for a lot of liquidity. It allows for people to leverage. It does a lot of things for markets in that, you know, genre. So on the other hand, though, you know, people are saying, well, you know, higher rates are actually potentially good for stocks. Now, I understand how the beginning of a rate hiking cycle can be very good for stocks. Well, let me back that up. The beginnings of a rate hike cycle can be a time when stocks do very well, because one of the things that, you know, and as you said, is that, well, why are they hiking rates? Because things are good. They need to make sure that, you know, the economy doesn't overheat to a point that, you know, inflation just spirals out of control and all that. But when you're saying is don't fight the Fed at the end of the rate hiking cycle, it seems to me that somewhere in the middle of it would really be a little bit more appropriate if we believe that we want to buy stocks when Fed is actually stimulating and reducing rates, and we want to buy stocks. I mean, you can't have it both ways, can you?
No, you can't have it both ways. Absolutely not. So what I'm saying is that historically, when you look at the data during tightening cycles, as the Fed's raising, if you look back, it's like the 18 months or 2 years that they're raising it, the market usually tends to go up the highest compared to when they stop. And then, you know, we'll see a little bit of a decline. So and you can't have it both ways. And you have to be careful when people say, well, low rates are good for stocks and high rates are good for stocks. What I'm saying is it's not the worst thing. What I'm saying, it's not the worst thing for stocks. Yeah. I'm not saying that every stock is cheap, but you're going to see separation in the market, right? We're seeing every stock go up, you know, as well as I do. We follow every sector in the market. There's a lot of stocks trading where they shouldn't be trading. right? So now you're going to have more of a stock picker's market where, you know, you have an entire sector, whether it was 3D printing back in the day, when you have, you know, cloud computing, big data, you got all these stocks move, AI now, all these stocks move up together, where you've seen the whole entire market. I mean, you know, you look around, it's kind of like just invest in anything you wanted over the past couple of years and chances are you're up. So it's not going to be like that anymore.
Which,
so
by the way, leads me into the ETF thing. I've been really on a soapbox about these ETFs, the whole market ETFs, where, you know, instead of investing in an individual stock, what the hell? What's the point of that, of doing all the research? Screw that. Nah, I'm just putting in an SPY or DIA or QQQ. And I think that because of the comment that you just made of, hey, you know what? Who cares? Because the market's just moving up. What's the point? That's what the thesis was for a number of years. Even some of the major hedge funds out there were buying these index funds. It's cheap. They can get into the whole market. Why bother, right? I wonder if some of the volatility is coming in right now because we have a lot less supply in the markets. A lot of companies bought back significant amounts of their shares. As a matter of fact, since 2010, I think 40% of the earnings increases have been attributable to buybacks. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
There was a stat that just came out a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. And we know this. I mean, this is something I've been fetching about for a long time. Mm-hmm. The whole idea that, you know, are these earnings good? And I've been always, let's look at the revenues, because companies are definitely, listen, if you have 10% less shares outstanding, your EPS is going to be up by if it doesn't change from last quarter, it's going to be up. And companies do that. That's how they can actually regulate their beats against analyst estimates. They just buy back a few more stocks, buy a few more shares. But my question is, if interest rates go up, it makes it a little bit harder, although there is repatriation now, but it makes it a little bit harder to actually look at two things. First, the opportunity for companies to leverage up further, to bring in money in order to buy back shares. Number two, the valuation differential when you're looking at a risk-free asset. That's a problem. And third, this whole idea that you mentioned of everybody, I'm kind of going into a little bit different directions here. I apologize. Mm-hmm. But the third thing is everybody's buying ETFs. And because of all this that's going on, and do you think that the ETFs buying and selling, whereas you're just buying an entire market in $1 swing, right? Do you think that the buying in ETFs with a lower amount of liquidity could turn out, and why we're seeing so much volatility?
Yeah, I think the ETFs have a lot to do with it. And it's funny because I punched up a stock the other day. I forgot what stock it was. And I think it was a large cap name, not too crazy. And I was looking to see, I was just going through data through Capital IQ. And for some reason, it came up and I hit a screen that said, what ETFs it's actually in. This stock was in 14 Vanguard ETFs. Yep. The same company, right? So think about that. The same company has found a way, Vanguard, to charge people 14 different times for owning the same stock, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at it, if it was, I don't even remember what kind, so, but say if it's a company like Intel, where it's going to be in a semis index, it's going to be in a robotics index because they're into robotics now and drones. It's going to be in AI. It's going to be in large cap technology. It's going to be in their S&P's fund. It's going to be in their dividend fund. So, you know, when I saw that, I was amazed. Like, I understand the ETFs, but the company specific with Vanguard, you really need one stock in 14 of your own ETFs.
Yep.
So they're finding ways. Yes, their fees are low and they say that, but, you know, when everything adds up, you know, one person owns Intel, you're charging how much for those people to own it. Maybe you're better off owning it individually. But yes, and that's why you're seeing a lot of these stocks in the same sectors move up in tandem. And then you throw in the algorithms, right? I mean, I know this is something that you track, where I've seen it during earnings season, where a stock opens up down 3-4% on, you know, whatever, okay earnings, right? That's the earnings season. Everything ran up into earnings and a lot of stocks beat and then they came off, right? It was 75% of stocks beat or 78%. So, yeah, when you see that happening and all of a sudden it comes down 3% and it finishes the day down 12-13%. And the same thing on the upside. I've had stocks in my portfolio when they're up 3-4% and next thing I know, I'll look at the end of the day, they're up 13%. I'm like, what? You know, and then they'll come off. So there's a lot of algorithm trades that are kicking in here as well. That's creating a lot of volatility, especially ETFs. I don't know how to correct it. I know everybody talks about
it,
but
there's
just
correct.
Way too many
ETFs. I'll tell you, Frank, what's going to happen is that it's a cycle. Just as over the last number of years, low volatility and just buying an index has worked out very well because it feeds on itself, right? People start buying an index, the index goes up, more people say, hey, I'm going to buy the index. I'm going to go away from stock pickers, mutual funds, fees are too high and all that. if we do see some corrective action in markets that is sustainable or volatility that's very significant, people are going to say, you know what? Maybe I want to be in an actively managed portfolio like a mutual fund, for example, in some mutual funds. Maybe I don't want to have all my money. Anybody kind of put all their money in ETFs because it was low fee. Or maybe they're going to say, you know, I should start picking individual names that I can understand more because I don't want to have the particular risk of an entire market in my portfolio. If I think that technology is going to do well or healthcare is going to do well or staples, whatever it is, maybe I'll look at that and I'll say, you know what? If there's going to be all this volatility, maybe I'll buy Procter & Gamble. That's what I'm going to hold in the portfolio, for one position. Just check that box. As opposed to all of them. You know, it used to be that you would go and find, when you worked in the area of momentum that was wrapped inside of value, so kind of growth at a reasonable price, what you would do is you would go find the indices that were doing well, the sectors. So you look at the consumer staples, say, what's the best stock in there from a growth trajectory? And you'd buy that, and that would be, or maybe two of them, that would be in your portfolio. Then you'd look at the technology area. You wouldn't just blanketly buy the entire sector or the entire market.
But we're looking, you know, if we look at it that way as individuals, but when you're looking at institutions, and that's where who's really buying these ETFs, right? There's a lot of institutions in there because they're able to hedge themselves on the massive positions they're taking. When you have funds that used to be $10 billion and they're $125 billion now, when you look at Bridgewater and all these massive funds are no longer $5 billion funds. It's $25 billion plus. So how do they do? They have to invest that money, right? If they don't invest that money, they don't collect fees. Mm-hmm. So how do they do that? Well, you know, we'll take a position in something and you know, an ETF will be created, which I'm sure this happens all the time. We saw in The Big Short where people, you know, the guy created his own product so he could short them. And everybody was laughing at him at the time, but not saying that that's the same scenario, but there's products out there where you're seeing institutions, massive institutions, right? And you throw in the algorithm tradings when these guys hold these things for a couple of minutes sometimes, maybe for a couple of hours, maybe a day or two. You know, they're using a lot of these ETFs as hedges. So, you know, you could do that when you have a good short position. So you want to maintain a short position because what do we know with short positions, right? When you have a short position, your risk is unlimited unless you're protecting yourself somehow. So, and who knows where how high a stock can go. We've seen that. Look at Amazon, look at Facebook, right? Like sometimes valuations don't matter. Those are great companies, but you want to be able to protect yourself because you know, like in 2 years from now, that you know what's going to hit the fan, this stock could go down or this sector could go down. But it could go a lot higher in the meantime. So a lot of people have been, the best short sellers that I talk to have always wrong. They always seem to be early, you know, even the nonprofit stuff. I mean, that stuff took off before a lot of that, you found out, you know, a lot of it was bankrupt. The housing market, those guys were short. How high did that go? And they almost got crushed out of that position before finally the housing market crashed.
Many did, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this is the institutions, which I worry about, but yeah, I mean, look, there's way, way, way too many ETFs. They keep coming out. It's insane. Mm-hmm. You can get an ETF for, you know, for fingernail technology stocks, there's a friggin' ETF now. It's a joke. It's a joke.
Pickles,
it's a joke. And they're not doing it for you. They're doing it because they know there's some people out there that are going to get assets in it, and they know they're going to be able to generate fees.
Well, they're hoping that it could take off and it would be an actual place that they're bringing the assets. I agree with you. Let's switch over to a couple different things. I want to just mention that you were on the show last on December 3rd, 2017. At the time, there was a particular sector that was being shunned. It was like, oh, this is over. It was the big box and the brick and mortar retail area. And it was like, nobody wanted to be in it. The whole Amazon effect concept kept on kind of rolling out. And these companies were doing very poorly. Now, one company I want to talk about in particular that you liked was Macy's. You like Macy's. I'll just read a quick list of the retail. Macy's, JCPenney, Kohl's, and you hedged it all with saying, oh, I like Amazon too. That was good. Can't go wrong with that. Just in case, I guess. But those are the four stocks that you liked. Now, Macy's, one of the things that I think that happened that was really beneficial, aside from the fact that it was, you know, so unloved, that's an understatement. It was so hated. Lundgren left, you know, the CEO. Mm-hmm. That was there for years. I never really cared for him. Yeah, mm-hmm. He seemed to be a spotlight hunter kind of guy. Like every time earnings came out, he's like, you know, you got a few of these, right? Anytime earnings got out, he's on CNBC the next day to try to either explain it away or take the credit for it.
Yeah.
But these stocks are up anywhere from about 15 to 25%, and some are a little bit more since then. Amazon had hit an all-time high just this week. Kohl's is kind of an interesting play. Clearly, the number, I think the biggest run has been in Macy's, which is kind of interesting. Now, where do you stand on the sector and where do you stand on these stocks today?
Look, when I liked this sector, it was October, November, when I saw guys on CNBC saying the malls are completely dead, which was the funniest thing I ever heard in my life. Because if you went to a mall during Christmas time, good luck. The time you parked, got whatever you had to do, and get back to your car was 2 hours. Okay, every mall, everywhere, and I have a podcast just like you, Wall Street Unplugged. I get information from all. Listen, I'm not a permable or a permabear, but it's great to have a massive network and have good podcasts, right? Because you get information from all over the world from your subscribers, which is fantastic. Right. It's like your own research team.
You know we are, by the way. We're perma podcasters.
Perma podcasters, yeah. I like that. I'm going to use that. So when you look at these stocks, I did a ton of research on these. And when I saw a guy get on CNBC and really, I'm going to really go after this guy a little bit because he basically made a call to get on fast money and it worked. He got on fast money. He downgraded JCPenney at $18, said it's a sell. It's going to go down to whatever it was, $13.50, whatever. And then he downgraded JCPenney and said it's a $1.50 price target. They're going to be in big trouble.
The first one was Macy's.
Macy's. Same day, right? So he had these. So everyone was like, you know, skeptical of the market. But then you had a guy who was just like, let me throw out the all-time street lows, right? This way, you know, you're going to get highlighted. And it's a young kid. He got on CNBC from Citigroup. And you know, he turned out to be very, very wrong. I was wrong on GE, LHG in the 20s. We're all wrong. But you have to be careful because we're in a market where people love to make bold calls because they're going to get attention. They're going to get more clicks. They're going to get on TV. And it worked. The guy got on Smart Money with a lot of those guys who you know, I have a lot of respect for those guys. They're really smart. I know they care about the people, the listeners. So when you look at the underlying fundamentals of the malls, they got destroyed. They were already down 60, 70%, right? And they got destroyed the last holiday season. Mm-hmm. So what these guys try to do against Amazon is they're like, all right, Amazon's lowering prices. We're going to lower prices too. By the way, your costs are like 50%, 70% higher. You'd be like, we're going to deliver one day. Yeah, so right. These guys, their sales exploded and their profit margins got destroyed. Right? Yep, so right. They tried to compete. So what happened over that whole entire year? Now they started getting into technology. They started getting big data analytics. They started getting into cloud. If you really look at the underlying things, what does that do? It allows you to have 100% control of your inventory. This way you don't get caught out there. It's the biggest thing for retailers. And if you look at every single company that reported, they were like, we manage inventory better. Amazon is doing a good thing, right? Because 100% is not going to be online e-commerce. Even Amazon is opening up big box stores right now, right? That's what they're doing. It took over Whole Foods. They need to open up big box. So there's a mix. You have to figure out the mix. And the fact that they got destroyed last time with all the mistakes they made, this time going in, they were smart. They were lean going in. You saw JCPenney come out and how many stores did these guys close?
Oh, yeah.
Like into the holiday season, which you normally don't see. I mean, these guys were lean. Their earnings were good. If you look at JCPenney, they had enough cash flow to last, you know, to pay their debt off. I think they had $3.5 billion in debt. And they had $4 billion, $5 billion in liquidity. So the company, you know, over the next 5 years, no matter what, they're not going to go out of business. And when you see JCPenney trading at under $2, it's saying that it's going out of business. We see Macy's at 18. And these companies are trading, they're generating earnings. Same store sales are lower. Yeah, you see that. But, and those are stores open for, you know, 12 months or longer. But when you look at the underlying fundamentals, Macy's was trading at 7-8 times forward earnings, 9 times forward earnings. They're still trading at 12-13 times forward earnings. You know, so you're seeing these stocks are dirt cheap where Walmart ran up 45% from October into the call. And it was like, it's the biggest decline. It went up 40% before that. Like from October to when they reported, I think it was late January. This stock was trading at 23 times earnings. It's trading at historically that stock, Walmart trades at what? 16, 17 times market multiples.
Yeah, so that was unbelievable.
But when you compare, I remember when I think looked at Walmart and said, whoa, look at, no, because the same companies that have run up 15, 20% are still trading at 10, 12 times earnings. That's you know, Target, Kohl's, JCPenney, even Best Buy. Best Buy has been doing great even longer because they figured out how to compete with Amazon. Amazon doesn't have Geek Squad where when you buy a lot of these high-end technologies, gadgets and everything, you want a TV set up. What is it, like 70% of people don't even have their high definition in the right settings in their TV. So these guys come, you want to put it on a wall. They do all this stuff. Well, you know, Amazon can't do that. So they found ways to compete and said, all right, we'll match.
Right.
Well, I don't know, unless they're going to open up big box stores everywhere.
But well, now they'll have it at Whole Foods. They'll put a Amazon squad in Whole Foods.
They could. They actually could. You know, that's something that they could do. But when you look at Best Buy is like, all right, we'll match the prices. But you know what? We're going to make it up in margins because we're going to have to install a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's fine.
Right.
And look what happened to their stores. They're more lean. It was a stock 70. I mean, people hated it, 30 and 40. So when you're looking at these retails, what Amazon is doing is a good thing. They're learning. It doesn't mean, listen, the malls aren't going away. If you talk to any kid out there, the malls are crowded. Well,
the malls can't go away because they got long-term leases and the companies can't get out of it.
Well, a lot of those leases are only about 60% of them are only like 2 years. So if you look at like 60, I think I read that 60% of those leases around malls, because I was looking at the REITs in that sector, are basically going to come up for renewal. But if the malls were dead, why would Apple, Tesla, Amazon, I mean, these are companies that are all, Microsoft, they're all opening stores in these areas. So it's just providing the right mix. I know it sounds great to say the mall's dead, get out of it. But the companies are trading as if they were going out of business, and now they're not. I still think Macy's has upside potential. It's dirt cheap. I still like Kohl's is really good, pulled off after their earnings, but I still think it's fantastic. It's run up tremendously.
I think Kohl's actually has made an announcement this week after the earnings call or during the earnings call. They're going to actually be doing a pilot program with Aldi, mm-hmm. which is a supermarket. So it's going to kind of like now all of a sudden you're going to have Kohl's, which is going to have a variety of housewares and clothing and all that. And I'm not sure if they're going to mix it with their stores in terms of having the food there or if they're going to sell and let Aldi actually use their stores in the malls. Because you don't usually see supermarkets and food in store in malls and give them some rent to see if that works for them. And then maybe they can offset some of their rental costs on some of the stores that aren't performing for them. I'm not sure which one it was, but there's some interesting note about that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Kohl's has run up tremendously. I mean, I wouldn't be buying Kohl's here, but I still think Macy's is a buy here. I still think that you're looking at I mean, Target's really been killing it. I really don't like Target up here either, but I still think Macy's is one of the best buys, and Nordstrom's a good buy here. I'd focus on those two that are dirt cheap, haven't run up as much as the other ones, but that was a trend. I felt like an island all by myself. And when that happens, guys, sometimes it's a good thing. It's frustrating because you're getting emails and people are like, you're an idiot. You don't know what you talk about. But you'll agree to this. When I write about things for my newsletters and everyone's like, that's great, that's awesome, I get nervous. When people are like, Frank, I don't know about this, man. This looks terrible. It usually means you're right. And you know, so when I got all that feedback, it was cool. But again, it was a good call. I just thought that sell-off was overdone, and those guys did a ton learning, right? I mean, they got destroyed. Look at it. What was JCPenney? It was $11. It went down to $2. And then a guy comes on and says, well, we're downgrading it to sell at $2 to $150. You know, it's kind of like, all right, beautiful. That's it. Here's the time to buy. And you know, a lot of those stocks with JCPenney's over $4 now.
So what other let's kind of move over to another area, something I know you follow very closely, and it's the whole we'll call it the mining space, you know, the general mining space. Gold has had a big run up through the end of the year, kind of started laying back a little bit. Silver also, copper had a big run. What are you looking at these days in terms of that whole space of, we'll call it, metals and mining?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that because I speak at a lot of mining conferences in Vancouver and Toronto, you know, a lot of different places. I see the same people there because they're 100% focused on mining, and you and I focus on every single sector, but I have a lot of great contacts in this industry, and I talk to a lot of the big CEOs of the big mining companies. Man, it's got to be tough being a mining CEO. You want to talk about a sector that's terrible, and uranium. It's, and those two sectors that, you know, are just outside of a small move higher in early 2016, since 2012 has been horrible. And people always said when I learned this industry, again, I've been fortunate to have great contacts and great people who taught me a lot, is you want to invest in people because one out of every three of those mines that they find, one of those 3,000 projects actually becomes a producing mine. So chances are, you know, most stocks are going to end up, especially the junior mine, is going to end up at zero eventually, maybe 5, 6, 7 years. Now, you always want to invest in people, and that was one of the biggest things, and geography is important, all this. You want to make sure they have enough cash on the balance sheet, but forget about that because the most important thing, yes, people are important, but it's not the most important thing because you invested in a mining company where the Pope was a CEO, you're still down 40%, 50% over the past few years. Didn't matter. What matters is the market conditions, right? So what do we see? Well, we're seeing low interest rates forever. We're seeing low inflation forever. You know, now look at what's happening. Now we're seeing underlying things that usually push gold higher. We're seeing inflation come up. That's why we're seeing gold prices come up. You know, we're seeing a Fed come out and say, we're going to raise rates. And they are going to raise rates, you know, aggressively pretty much the next 2 years. That's going to be very good for gold. You know, it seems contrary, right? You're like, well, interest rates are going to be higher and gold doesn't pay. But gold actually moves higher during those times or in high interest rates environments. I mean, you could take inflation. I don't want to get too technical and say, you know, with inflation, we're still, you know, it's zero. But there's underlying fundamentals right now that you see in gold that really do well. And that's those conditions are going to exist at least for the next 18 months. So what happens? Gold prices usually go higher And then you usually see the royalty companies go higher. And we're seeing that, right? This has been the trend for decades. Gold royalty companies go higher, right? They take pieces of projects. They only have like 12 people, like finance companies. Then you see the gold producers start going higher, and then you see the juniors. And when these juniors go higher, they don't go higher by 20, 40%. They go 3, 4, 500% higher, and it could happen 6, 7 months. My advice is find good junior miners. We cover a lot of these in our newsletters that have good management teams, that have a lot of cash in a balance sheet. They don't need to raise money. Put a couple of these in your portfolio. Have like 2%, 3% exposure, because if you hit this trend and the cycle turns out to be in your favor, that's going to result in 7, 8% of your portfolio. That's how high these stocks could go. I've been part of this several times, been able to time it pretty good. And right now, I think with gold prices going higher, these junior miners are still down 70, 80, 90% from their highs in 2012, providing amazing opportunities. They have great projects. And I think you can make a lot of money in this sector. And look, you're buying the one of the sectors that really hasn't been high. I mean, even emerging markets are high. Everything in the U.S. has been higher in the last 7, 8, 9 years. That's one sector that's been really terrible. I think you can spot a lot of value right now, especially with the fundamental, at least the macro part of the metals industry, looks very positive for the first time in a lot of years.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of people have come out with the comment that, you know, gold was the alternative asset of yesteryear for the old fuddy-duddies out there that wanted to have something that was helpful to diversify their portfolio, and it wasn't necessarily correlated to the current, you know, portfolio and what they have now, and equities and bonds and all. And they buy gold, they buy silver and all that. But that's for the old farts, man. Today we buy cryptocurrencies. That's what it is. That's that's diversifying, and that's giving. What do you think about that? And there was some thought that, well, a lot of the money that used to go into gold is going into cryptos these days. What's your thought on that?
I agree. Oh, I mean, a lot of money. I speak. Could you hear me, Glenn?
Yeah. No, I was saying hello as in.
Oh, I didn't.
Like,
no.
Hello.
Hello. No, but I agree with you. Listen, I speak a lot of these conferences, probably about 4 or 5 a year. And the last 4 or 5 months, I've been going to conferences that are called like the Silver and Gold Summit, the Mining Resource Symposium, whatever it is. And it's been dominated by cryptocurrencies, dominated. All the mining guys are starting to get into cryptocurrencies and data mining plays and stocks like that. Not necessarily ICOs, but you know, when you have that speculative money, I mean, the amount of money that could be raised if you come in with hey, I'm starting a data mining company, right? And it's going to focus on Bitcoin, and we need these, you know, S9 ant miners, and we're going to buy 5,000. We're going to be in Sweden where it's, you know, electricity prices are low, and we get subsidies and all that crap. You could literally, by the time you announce that at stage, by the time you get to the door, you'll raise $15 million. If I say I have a great gold company, they just produce, I have a great management team, they just produced, we're right next door to one of the biggest producing mines in the world. Nobody wants to invest in it because it's such a terrible sector. So I think a lot of money has come out, you know, money that could go into the mining sector, especially junior miners. I would agree with that. I really do. I think that, you know, everybody I talk to about it in the industry doesn't agree with me, but you have to be careful when you're talking to CEOs because their job, just like it's your job, Andrew, my job for our company, we're always going to talk positive about our company, right? We're never going to say, well, you know, things that nobody does that, right? So you always, no matter what happens, you're going to talk positive about it. But in the end, when you're looking at the mining companies, you know, they don't want to admit that that's the case, but I think that was the case. And but that's also provided a really good opportunity because these things are really dirt cheap, the junior miners. So I think you're going to see more money flow into these, especially as gold prices are going to go higher. And I think they are going to go higher, not because it's an alternative currency. And be very careful. Listen to these crazy libertarians. That's, you know, it's so funny. Listen to them because you can literally what they say today. You can go back to 1980. It's the same speech. America, the dollar's going to crash. It's going to be over. There should be no regulation. In the meantime, these guys made their fortunes in America, which is a free country. I would love to see no regulation. This way you have like 5 guys and they're beating the crap out of them, stealing all their money. And they'll be like, wait, maybe we need regulation. You know, it's just,
well, the whole, the whole argument
so
with gold
out there.
Yeah, the whole thing about using gold as an alternative currency, it sounds great, but you know when the S hits the fan, you know it's going to be very difficult for you to try to chip off a little piece of gold. I mean, coins are one thing, but you know how are you going to slice off a little bit of gold to buy a loaf of bread?
How do you know it's real? How do you get it out of your country? That's the thing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin, if you're thinking Bitcoin's a fad. It's not. It's for real. I mean, you're looking at this thing go up, and a lot of this is taking place even in China. But if China wants, if there's someone in China wants to get their money out of the country, that's the easiest way to do it. That's a transfer of payment. You can't take gold. One, you're not even. You get stopped at the airport. They'll confiscate it. You know, you can't. they have access to all of your accounts, right? So you can't really, it's very difficult to wire transfer money, but Bitcoin is the way that you could do it through the blockchain, through, you know, a decentralized ledger. And that's what you're seeing. Does this industry need a ton of regulation? Absolutely. I mean, it's crazy. You got idiots like Long Island Tea Company changing their name to blockchain, whatever, and the stock goes out 2,000%. You know, but you, and I love that the fact the SEC is coming after these guys, because this needs to be regulated, need to be have accountability. But this is a real trend. I mean, this is something. Look, this blockchain threatens. Okay, the reason why you have Goldman Sachs, you have JP Morgan, all the major financial companies are investing in blockchain. The reason why is not because they want to make money, because it threatens the reason why these the foundations of their businesses were built on. Okay, this is all fees, transfer payments. They charge you everything. You have your own money. You get charged for wiring money to somebody. You know, if you don't have enough money in your bank account, all they do is fee you to death. Now you have a blockchain where you could transfer money just about anywhere, and those fees are going to come down, and you don't have to have accountability and all this crazy stuff. But it does need to be regulated. But if you want to know if this trend's real, just, you know, look at the massive financial companies that are all investing in this. You look at Intel, Google. All these guys are investing in it right now because they're starting to understand it. JP Morgan, JB Diamond took back his comments. It was another huge hedge fund manager. I forgot his name. Manages like $50 billion. Said it's a joke, and then came out and said, you know what? I talked to a lot of people on this, and this actually isn't a joke. You know, so the more you understand about this market, it's for real. You know, maybe it doesn't go as high, and you know, it's going to be volatile, but it's here. It's going to stay here.
Yep. So what else do you see as opportunistic? And maybe let's kind of, we've been talking about some of the good things about the benefits of maybe being in retail and some of the junior miners and cryptos and the good economics. Where are some problem areas?
That's a good question. I mean, the problem areas are the companies, you know, I see it with a lot of individual. I think the problem areas are the consumer staples. I think those guys are going to be in big trouble because, I mean, that's an industry that's just trades average 14, 15 times earnings historically. These things are trading at, some of these names are trading at 22 times forward earnings. They're not really growing sales that fast. They're not really growing earnings that much. They have more competition than ever. I mean, think about it, you know, General Mills, a company like that, where if you go to your local supermarket, you'll see, you know, even Kellogg's or whatever, you'll see, you know, Frosted Flakes. And right next to it, Frosted Flakes is $5 for a box of Frosted Flakes. And right next to it is like, you know, your brand, like the store's brand for like $1.50. You know, so they're having trouble. And that's why when you get potato chips where they charge you much more and you have like two potato chips in the bag. I mean, it's getting to the point where they can't find margins anywhere, and these stocks are trading through the roof. And you're starting to see these guys get hit. But the reason why they're trading through the roof is because we had low interest rates. We needed a place to put our money. And hey, you know what? These are great 3% yields, 3.5% yields. Now they're much lower because the stocks are higher. But they just don't have the fundamentals to support that. And now that interest rates are going higher, you're going to have more alternatives to put your money. I'm going to see a lot of money come out of that sector, which is really expensive. And you know what? That's where a lot of retirees have their money. I mean, they have their money in these so-called safe stocks that usually, it's like housing. Housing is a safe investment, right? It goes up, whatever, 2% a year on average. You know what? But during the credit crisis, right before that, like whatever, 2005, 6, 7, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, it went up 25% annually. Mm-hmm. So what do you think was going to happen? Like right now, these stocks aren't used to going up 20% annually for 5 years. They usually go up, you know, like with the market, 6, 7% a year. They're well ahead of themselves, and these people believe they're safe stock because they see the businesses, they eat the food.
Good dividends.
Good dividends, but be very, very careful because these things are really expensive, and they deserve that premium when interest rates are zero. I get it. I understand. But it gets to a level where, okay, interest rates are rising. You're taking away, you know, that catalyst that they had and the reason why. But that's why you've seen them underperform lately, but you've seen a lot of these stocks, even the food companies. Del Monte got crushed. Just so many stocks within this area have gotten nailed, and I think you're going to continue to see that. So be very careful if you own these things because, the so-called safe stocks are not really that safe. They're very expensive, and they're not growing earnings and sales like the rest of the market.
Yeah, I mean, and what about some of these areas? I mean, what do you see the impact of the U.S. dollar rising on multinationals?
You know what, Andrew? I never bought a stock or sold the stock based on currency. That's just me, right? I mean, even when companies report, they'll tell you, here's a number, X currency, here it is. And if it's not, if it's in their favor, they don't say X currency, right?
Of course
they
not.
Just report the number. But, you know, when you look at multinationals, you're looking at every one of those markets. I could tell you, you should have exposure to international markets. I mean, they've lagged. They're a lot of them are 52-week highs, but they still lag the market. I mean, their run just started, you know? So we had a run for 7, 8, 9 years. Their run just started. You're seeing strong earnings. Not that you have to go and invest in individual companies. Maybe that is a good way to buy an ETF. That, I think, is an advantage because you can't really go to China and buy these stocks. You know, you could buy whatever it is that, you know, it's the 25 largest companies in China, whatever, and they have ETFs like that. Or you could play it through the S&P 500, where a lot of these companies have, I think the average has, what, 45% of the sales overseas?
The big ones.
Comes from overseas. So, you know, I think you could play, you know, a lot of different countries that way. But, that, I mean, those markets are booming. They finally figured it out. They, you know, they've had the, they announced their stimulus plans and everything they're going to do. And they have that, they did that a lot later than us. And now you've seen those markets move. And I think that's becoming a really good alternative to the U.S. market, too. So you've seen a lot of money flow into
every single person that we talk with, from various fund companies and analysts that we talk with, the number one place they're looking at is small to mid-cap internationals. That's what they like.
Can't blame them. Because what do you have, right? You always want to invest in cheap stocks, but value, you want to avoid value traps. How do you do that? You want to make sure there's a catalyst. You want to make sure there's growth. You have the political systems in place that are ensuring growth, right? I mean, right. You know, that's what they're doing. And now these things are still cheap, so you have both of those. And when you have both of those, we don't really have that in the U.S. Not everything is cheap. Right, we really don't. And not every company is growing fast. Yeah, I would tell you that I think Netflix deserves a multiple, Facebook and Amazon deserves those multiples because they're growing. They keep putting up, they're growing, and that's what they want to see. As long as they keep continue to grow, they're going to go higher. But you know, now you have the markets, but they're expensive. So if you can get growth potential at a cheap valuation, that's why a lot of people are turning to those markets now.
Right. Well, let's wrap it up here with a couple of things. First of all, I know that we're working on a special offer of some of your research to my listeners, which will let the cat out of the bag soon. So if you haven't signed up for the Disciplined Investor email list, just hop on the disciplinedinvestor.com. You'll probably get a little pop-up, put your name and email in there, and we'll make sure to send that out to you when it becomes available. But also you can find out all sorts of information. First of all, listening to Frank's wonderful podcast. It's a Wall Street Unplugged, and you can find that on, of course, all sorts of podcast services anywhere that there is one. Also on CurzioResearch.com. You still doing Frankly Speaking?
Yeah, I still do Frankly Speaking. So that's my Friday podcast I do once a week where I take questions and everybody emails frank@curzioresearch.com. They send in questions and I'll pull a few and just answer them, you know, four or five on Friday. And that really goes well. It's funny, really quick. And I don't know if you do this, if you answer questions, but when you answer them, the response you get is like, you know, it's like they just saw Tom Cruise. I'm like, I'm a regular guy just like you guys. I'm not famous or nothing. I'm just answering. Like, I can't believe you put me on the air. It's so great. I'm like, for me, I can't believe you actually took the time to email me to send me a question. The least I could do is try to help you out. And I really appreciate that. And you know, just like you, we're humbled by how big the following is. And we were in this podcast thing early and it's growing. It's a lot of fun. And it's cool when you really see the responses and emails and the lives that you touch. And it's really awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Frank Curzio, CurzioResearch.com. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. We'll have the information on how to research and find and understand and get in touch with Frank over on episode number 550 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, Frank, talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks. Bye. As always, a wealth of information. That's great. You can find out all about where to find information on Frank, of course, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I think next week I got a couple of things I want to talk to you about with regard to some questions that you had sent in. Also, I have some interesting news on some conferences that are coming up that you may be interested in going to. And we'll try to really dig down and talk about some of the maybe individual positions that are out there that are interesting. But you can find out, like I said, all about Frank on thedisciplinedinvestor.com or go to frankcurzio.com or curzioresearch.com. It's all around there. Lots of good stuff to dig down on. And all the show notes will be on the site as well. So anyway, thanks so much for joining me this week. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Get some good rest. Get ready for next week. And I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.